Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black power, black power, black power, brothers and sisters. Tonight, Sunday night, we're going to do a political education recap. We were normally supposed to have our minister, I'm sorry, we were supposed to have our national spokesman, Brother Malik Maumau, to come on today, but unfortunately he won't be able to make it. Hopefully we'll have our brother on tomorrow. He reached out earlier to let me know that he wouldn't be on, and that he'll do his best to get on tomorrow. So what we'll do, we're going to do a political education recap. As we know, we are in the beginning of 2022, and with that, a new year, we're going to put all the old things to the past and move forward right now with the future. So I'm going to start off this program tonight. Hopefully this clip plays. I tried to play it before. I don't know if it hadn't processed yet, but this clip is going to be from Sister Afiyong Afiyong, and it's entitled 21st Century Pan-Africanism, Black Power. Ludie, no, you gotta come get my card. No, you gotta come get this card. Come get this card. This card. Oh, it's not. This clip won't play. Okay. I paid for the subway. I sent you the confirmation number, but I was thinking you go to Shell and get the, some clothes. Mm-hmm. But you got to call me when you get the sale so I can activate the card. Because Amazon keeps trying to hit me up.
Yeah.
So every time I make a purchase, I disable the card.
Okay, and I'm so, ready. So I'm going to Subway first.
Yeah, Subway, they say this should be ready at 7:15.
Yeah, I got that text right there.
But you can go to whichever one quick.
Well, I'm going to shoot up to Family Dollar and get a loaf of bread and have a gallon of orange juice and sunny. So when I leave Subway, I'm run in out of Amazon and then
Amazon.
Come on, run in and out of $100 and then hit the sale.
Okay, but you gotta call me when you get the sale so I can activate the card. That's cool. Uh oh. Can y'all hear me, brothers and sisters? This clip is not playing. All right, no luck on that clip. I don't know what happened. I uploaded this clip. It's saying that it said that the clip had 55 minutes, but for some reason, it's not playing. So what I'm going to do and keep it in vain with Pan-Africanism, I'm going to play our great elder. Actually, this is a combination of our great elder, Dr. John Henry Clark, and then Ambassador Arakana. This is a two-part clip. It'll be a mix of Dr. John Henry Clark as well as our great sister, Ambassador Arakana. 2022, how are you everybody out here in Black Nation land? The new Black Panther Party is very excited. We have a lot of things that we are jumping into regarding this new year. Several enterprises are getting into place. We are very much working directly with the folks within COBRA, as well as they are pushing strong with reparations. I spoke with Brother Demoke today in regards to the reparations movement. That's definitely on the forefront. Of course, 2022, we are not stopping in any shape, form, or fashion on exposing the corruption behind this biological weapon that we've been hit with the coronavirus and this mass extermination plot, which includes this jab. You know, this jab, what is going on with this jab? I think we're going to play something on that as well. When I'm saying this jab, I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. We're talking about the COVID vaccine. We talk about the COVID vaccine. This is a biological weapon in and of itself. I mean, come on, folks. You know that these vaccines are not curing anyone. So if it's not curing you or stopping you from getting the virus, what is it that you're injecting into your body? I mean, in 2022, beyond anything, I would hope that our people would start trying to develop some kind of common sense. Common sense. And what I'm going to do, and speaking of common sense, I'm going to start off with John Henry Clark speaking on African wisdom. I think that's a good start. Speaking on African wisdom, because, in fact, there's another piece he's got entitled Pan-Africanism or Perish, because we are dealing with a global issue. This vaccine has attacked the whole planet. So I'm going to play this John Henry Clark. Let me go back to this discussion. We are dealing in 2022. We're still dealing with the COVID. But as a people, there are certain agendas that we need to be focused on. Reparations is at the top of this agenda. Reparations is at the top of the agenda. We also, the New Black Panther Party, we will never forget. We will continually fight for the freedom of our political prisoners of the Black Liberation Movement. And in addition to that, brothers and sisters, there is much work to be done in the fields of justice, as we are still dealing in a very unjust system. But also, we must be in positioning ourselves and working directly with our people on the continent of Africa, as we are witnessing the industrial revolution taking place in Africa, and we have the opportunity with our skill set and knowledge to be a part of that. So you will hear a lot in 2022 on us not only bringing people presenting what's going on in Africa, but you will find out about the different enterprises that we are doing to be a part of the industrial revolution. And right here, there are industries that we're getting involved in: agriculture, transportation, building, economics, finance, becoming totally self-determined. Well, all of those things that we talked about in Kwanzaa and the principles of the Nguzu Saba, unity, cooperative work and economics, collective work, creativity, purpose, self-determination, faith, those things we put in place year-round. So with that being said, we're going to start off with a clip from our great elder, Dr. John Henry Clark, and this clip is entitled Pan-Africanism or Perish, and that is very relevant. There is no separating us on this planet. We have what we call artificial borders. The plight of our people here in Texas is the same as our plight of our people right next door in Louisiana or Oklahoma or Georgia or New York or California or Illinois or the Caribbean island or in Brazil or in Cuba or in Angola or in the UK or in South Africa. And that problem is the so-called system of white supremacy and imperialism and all of its vestiges, the colonialism. It must all end on our watch. And we are very much a part of developing our own sovereignty, nation statehood, and everything that comes with being independent and self-determined. Everything is on the table. We accept our indigenous heritage as being the original people of this land, as well as the fact that our people were, our ancestors were brought here and forced to do so-called slavery during the chattel slavery time that stemmed from the 1500s on up until today, as the prison industrial complex is very much slavery by another name. So I'm going to drop this John Henry Clark, and then we'll play some of our other great and wise brothers and sisters. But let me kick it off right now, John Henry Clark. There's a combination I'm looking at in our database here. It says it's a mix with some Dr. Eric Conner and John Henry Clark. So many choices. Let me do that one. I'm going to play a mix between Eric Conner, Dr. Eric Conner, the sister, who is very much active and working on the Pan-African front right now. And then we'll have some mix with some clips from Dr. John Henry Clark, a great elder who is now in the realm of the ancestors. And that will give us balance. Ashe, Black Power.
We were way ahead of them in our civilization. They set out to destroy us. and Berlin Conference put the nail on that coffin. So they gave Djibouti the same sovereignty as the United States. They gave Burundi the same sovereignty as China. They gave Togo. You see, the EU realizes individual little countries, they can't survive on the world stage. So they come together as the European Union. Now picture this now. So they cut up this Africa into the tiny little countries, small economies that could never survive on their own, but gave them the same sovereignty as the big boys. So that way, when the little bitty countries go to the world stage for the purposes of development and discussing trade, they're wannabe boxers who are being thrown into the heavyweight boxing ring every day. How do you put China in the same boxing ring with Eswatini? Eswatini has 1.2 million people. China has 1.4 billion people. And you put them on the same stage and say, go at it, negotiate. Are you with me? This is insanity of the highest order. How have we allowed this carnage to go on? When Eswatini is thrown in the same boxing ring with China and Eswatini is collapsing before Eswatini even gets on the stage, the world says, well, Eswatini, what's wrong with you? Why can't you take care of your people? Well, China came in and said, Eswatini, give me all your gold or else. And if Eswatini does not agree, they just go on next door to Lesotho and give Lesotho an extra dollar. And if Lesotho doesn't take it, they just jump on to Togo, Central African Republic. It was all by design, 1884. They did something else in addition to chopping us up. They also set out to make the African believe that everything African was bad and undesirable, and everything Western, particularly French and British, was more desirable. We call that the legacy of colonization. Prior to that, they had started long working on the slaves. Make them think everything about them, forget anything about Africa. Where you come from is a horrible place, diseased and dying people, constantly at war with themselves, uncivilized. Cut out any communications with them. You need to just know what we tell you. And we call that the legacy of slavery. So that way, you look at where we are today. 135 years later, a system that was put in place to see to it that Africa and her children are forever defeated, that Africa is forever exploited, remains in place today, alive and well. And we sit here and we ask ourselves, why isn't Africa moving forward? Why does Africa continue to be taken advantage of? Well, I'll tell you why, very simply. Until Africa comes together as a continent speaking with one voice, one continent, one people, nothing, and I repeat, nothing is going to change. As individual little African countries, we are wannabe boxers. We will never make it fighting against the heavyweights. We must speak with one voice. Yeah. And this is exactly what our Pan-African leaders wanted to see happen in 1963 when they came together in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. They clearly stated that Africa for the Africans at home and abroad, and that African Union was now. They said Africa must speak with one voice. It is the only way for Africa to take its rightful place on the world stage. Sadly, when they went to Addis Ababa in 1963, they were divided. We had two factions, the Casablanca group and the Monrovia group. The Casablanca group were saying Africa for the Africans at home and abroad, and African Union now. This was Ghana, Guinea, Mali, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Only 7. The other 25 of the 32 who attended was the Monrovia group. They were the nationalists. They said, let's go slow. Just kind of wait on this Pan-African thing. 55 years later, 56 this year, we're still going slow. As if it wasn't bad enough that we were divided up into the tiny little countries that we are today. The gift that Berlin Conference gave us. One other thing that France did between 1958 and 1961 in the name of giving us our independence as African countries. France forced the Francophone, and I hate that terminology. There is no such thing as Francophone, Anglophone. They made it up. But for the purposes of communication, I will use that. 14 of those countries, they said, in order for you to get your independence from us, you must sign this document. You thought they could have found a better name for the document. The document was called the Pact for the Continuation. I repeat, the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization. We are talking about giving you independence, but sign this pact for the continuation of colonization in a different format. And I'm going to highlight some of those issues that they said you must agree to if you are going to be independent. Hello. Maybe we need to redefine the meaning of independence for the French. France said, you see, you monkeys, you don't know how to manage your money. We're going to demand that you deposit 85% of your bank reserves with the French Minister of Finance. Under the French Central Bank, under the control of the French Minister of Finance. France is then going to take your 85% bank deposits from each and every one of you. Deposit those funds in the French stock market under the French name. And you may or may not know the returns. Today, as we speak, the latest figures are saying for every 14 billion that France invests in the stock market from Africa, they are realizing upwards of 300 billion in return. Every year, year in, year out, because of these deposits from the African countries, France is taking out of Africa over $500 billion. Now figure it out. For every 14 billion, the returns on the investment are over 300 billion, and they are taking over 500 billion. So in actuality, France is taking out of Africa trillions of dollars year in and year out from us poor people, Africans. Back to the pact. So should you want to access some of your money that you have deposited with France, you have to submit your country's financial returns. And if approved, you get to get it as a loan. You can only access up to 20% of your money year in, year out as a loan at commercial interest rates. Your own money. As if that was not enough. They said all your minerals discovered, yet to be discovered, all your oil discovered, yet to be discovered, France and French companies have the first right of refusal. If there's anything left over that the French companies do not want, your people might have. To this day. They said you will only use the currency that we created for you because you are special Africans. We call it the CFA. There was the Central African CFA and the Western African CFA, same animal. And that France is the only one that can print it for you. 1958. Fast forward. They're still printing it for us. And if you start misbehaving, they just stop printing your money. And your country's in trouble. They also said your language of instruction shall be French, whether you like it or not. That France will have military presence in your country, that your military can only be trained by France, that you can only buy military equipment from France, that you cannot have any military alliance with your neighbor, and that in the event of war, your allegiance is only to France. And furthermore, because they have military presence in your country, they can invade you without notice should they feel that the interests of France in your country are being violated. Fast forward, 2019, nothing has changed. The same people who have the audacity to tell us that we are poor countries, they are taking trillions out of Africa every year. And what is the African doing? Like an obedient, programmed black man, we just give in. We know the facts, but we just do nothing about it. Now, you have to say some of the fears are real, because the France that has sold you inferior equipment to theirs, France that has trained your military to be inferior to their military, they are now in your country. They can invade you. They have the permission to do so. They can destabilize you. And then one might say, why is it that African leaders haven't done anything about this deplorable situation? Well, let me tell you, my brother and sister, they have tried. Documented to this day, 22 coups where leaders were assassinated. France had something to do with it. The first seven, when they decided they were pulling out of the CFA and that they're going to print their own money, they were assassinated. Every time an African leader has tried to do what's best for their country, they were assassinated. Majority of them aided by France. It's a known fact. And then others, they were just mercenaries who felt that when there was a natural resource discovered in one country, they wanted to create a coup. So while the country is thrown into a civil war, they're siphoning the natural resource. We know of one particular story that had we not known about it, it would have been, oh, there we go again, the Africans. In about 25 years ago, a group of young, rich, white kids were having fun in Cape Town. They found out that there was oil in Equatorial Guinea that just been discovered, and they wanted it. So they set out a plan to have a coup in Equatorial Guinea. So while the Guineans are busy fighting a civil war, they will be siphoning the oil. But they made one mistake. There were two planes. One was to leave South Africa, stop in Zimbabwe, pick up more ammunition on their way to hunt in Equatorial Guinea. Another plane was taking off in the Caribbean that had this puppet diaspora who was supposed to be the next president. Mugabe wondered why such young people needed such powerful ammunition to go hunt in Equatorial Guinea. In doing his research further, he found out that this was a coup in the making. He allowed them to land in Zimbabwe. They loaded their plane, and just before takeoff, they were all arrested. The ringleader of that group was none other than the son of the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher. She had to fly to Zimbabwe and paid handsomely to get her son out. The last one of those prisoners left Zimbabwe about 6-7 years ago. Had these young people succeeded, it would have been another coup. There you go, the Africans again. Such, my brothers and sisters, is the story of your Africa. They don't do coups anymore. They simply create instability. So when you hear of an instability in an African country, ask yourself, what is really going on? Because what they are telling you is really going on is just a shiny object. The real issue is over here. And you need to stop before you start being used as an instrument of your own self-destruction.
Countries. We must understand that. The question then becomes, is that going to be the destiny that we are going to leave our children? where we have no control of our natural resources, where we'll never be able to be in a position to own our Africa. As a mother, as a grandmother, I would like to say hell to the NO. We cannot allow that to happen. And I know when I say that, I'm speaking on behalf of millions of mothers and millions of grandmothers out there. As the origins of humanity, as black women, we are mothers of humanity. As black men, you are fathers of humanity. Life as we know it began in Africa. Why is it then the originators of humanity as we know it are being treated as the scum of the earth? The world knows what is being done to Africa is unacceptable. The exploitation of Africa can no longer continue. There are many good people who are not black who wish Africa well. The biggest problem I found is that they simply do not know the games the powers that be are playing against our Africa. Many well-meaning people, they are sending donations to Africa. They're sending aid to Africa. If only they understood that Africa, the economic status of Africa, is designed to be that way. It is a plan that fits into the bigger global picture. And that until we begin to understand what is being done to us, there's no way we can begin to change our circumstances. I remember when I started speaking to what France was doing to Africa, and I highlighted the pact for the continuation of colonization. I was once talking to a class at one of the universities, and one of the students was French. Even as late as last year, he asked a question and he said, "Ambassador, I grew up in France and we were taught that the Africans were not civilized and that the French went to Africa to civilize the Africans. I never heard what you're talking about the French taking over $500 billion out of Africa every year. French themselves, French citizens, were not aware of what their government was doing in Africa. The same is true with many citizens of those Western countries that are exploiting Africa. The well-meaning citizens of those countries are not aware of the bigger strategy, the games that are being played by their governments on Africa. Everybody feels sorry for the continent. I wonder how these individuals who set out to exploit the motherland, how do they go to sleep every day? How do they tolerate the suffering that Africa is enduring? The millions of babies who are dying every day from starvation, the millions of women who are dying every day while giving birth to another life, the millions of unemployed youth who are dying, committing suicide, some of them, out of desperation, hopelessness, and despair. All those conditions created by those who seek to continue to exploit our continent. What they do is create situations that we end up fighting ourselves over piddly little things that don't ultimately matter. Because until they decide that Africa can change, nothing is going to change. The problem is, we, the victims also, don't quite fully understand what is being done to us. So we are meant to fight for which brother, which sister got more of the chunk under the table. First, we must realize that they don't see us as their equals. First, we must realize that we are under the table. First, we must realize this table is in our house. And that the food they are eating is food that we would have cooked for them. Then we go under the table and we wait for them to drop off a few crumbs as aid to our beloved continent. Crumbs from our food that they are eating on our table in our home. The only problem is we don't realize that we are under the table. And while we are under the table, they are making rules, creating laws, and systems that keep us under the table fighting over which brother and which sister got the larger chunk of the crumbs under the table. And while we are under the table, they want us to engage in diplomatic conversations. How do you have a diplomatic conversation with someone who is sitting on the table eating your food and you are under the table and we are supposed to be nice? Let's have a diplomatic conversation. Until they go back to their home and make their own food and eat off of their tables, and we stay in our own homes eating our food on our tables, then and only then can we have truly diplomatic conversations as equals. That scenario is not where we are today. They don't see Africans as humans. They don't see Africans as humans feeling just like they do. They don't see Africans as people who have desires just like their children wherever they live, in particular the Europeans. What French kids, what German kids, what British kids need is exactly what African kids need too. The difference is we, the truly rich people, we are being treated as the poor ones. And after they have exploited us and they are siphoning our natural resources, they add value to our natural resources, they create jobs in their countries, they bring goods with added value back to Africa, and we are reduced to being, once again, consumers. We are reduced to being, once again, consumers. Look at West Africa and cocoa beans. We have a whole city of Hershey built out of cocoa beans from West Africa. We have a whole city called Cadbury built out of cocoa beans from West Africa. Where is Cadbury City in Africa? Where is Hershey City in Africa? Look at Switzerland. We go to hotels and grocery stores all over Africa. We are buying Swiss coffee, Swiss chocolate. Since when did Switzerland grow so much coffee? Since when did the Switzerland grow so much tea? Grow chocolates, cocoa beans. It's all coming out of Africa. Some of the best teas and coffees are coming out of West Africa. Our farmers are being paid pennies to the dollar. And once again, we drink Swiss coffee that came from Ethiopia. Swiss coffee from Uganda via Switzerland. That is what I'm talking about, my brothers and sisters. It's about the exploitation of Africa that has been going on for centuries. That exploitation can no longer continue. There is too much suffering in our Africa. And we, the African diaspora, are the only ones, in my humble opinion, who can see clearly what is going on in our Africa. It's very difficult for a man who's struggling to make ends meet in Malawi to think continental. His day-to-day survival alone is mission impossible. And then you ask him to look at the bigger picture and think continental. We have a responsibility to pick up where our Pan-African fathers left. In 1963, when they met and failed to reach a consensus of building an Africa that spoke with one voice, as one continent, one heart, one mind, one soul. So they come up with a compromise decision which they called the Organization of African Unity. Year in and year out, our African leaders would meet, and the issue of an Africa speaking with one voice was raised, and year in and year out, they failed to reach a consensus until April of 2018, when our African leaders finally agreed on a decision which they are now calling the African Continental Free Trade Area. The African Continental Free Trade Area dictates that come 2021, when the implementation begins, Africa is going to enter the world market as one customs union. The heads of states are saying, no more shall Malawi, shall Botswana, shall Tunisia, with their litty-bitty basket, go to the world market, while China is coming with a warship, and they're supposed to be equal on this globalized market. African countries are defeated. That's why they have no voice in dictating the price of our natural resources. They tell us what they want to pay us for our natural resources. Who does that? So the African Continental Free Trade Area is supposed to end all that. Here is the dilemma, my brothers and sisters. The brain drain out of Africa that started over 400 years ago continues to this very day. We have children of Africa who were taken out of Africa as slaves. They took the best and the fittest wood they felt would survive the transatlantic journey, followed by the more recent immigrants who left in search of greener pastures, others running away from wars and famine. The end result is Africa does not have the capacity, intellectual capacity, that Africa needs to build the Africa that we want. Let me remind you that the colonizers for over 600 years, they have been building the Africa that they wanted. An Africa that was designed and built roads that took the lumber from the forest to the nearest exit point out of that country. Railway lines that went from the mine to the nearest exit point out of that country. It was an Africa that worked for them. It was an Africa that they wanted. But now this moment is calling for Africans to stand up, and we must build the Africa that we want. The Africa that works for the children of Africa at home and abroad. The reality on the ground, my brothers and sisters, as we are looking towards the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Area, let's be clear about one thing. There's not a single African country today that has the capacity to build a railway line. There's not a single African country today that has the capacity to build an airport. Together, however, with the capacity that is currently on the continent, and the capacity of the African diaspora around the globe, we have what we need to build the Africa that we want. It is therefore, my brothers and sisters, that I urge you to understand the importance of reversing the brain drain. The brain drain of many centuries out of Africa must be reversed. And that journey of reversing the brain drain begins now. It begins with you understanding the importance of us cleansing our minds of this horrible disease that is called the legacy of colonization, the legacy of slavery, the disease that has taught us to hate ourselves, the disease that has told us to dislike each other, to not trust each other, the disease that is keeping us even as we live here in the United States. And I know we have others who are listening from outside the United States, but I'd like to use the U.S. as an example because it is a perfect melting pot, which is a perfect example. We're surrounded by what other ethnic groups are doing. Ask for the voices of the Indian diaspora, loud and clear. Ask for the voices of the Chinese diaspora, the Irish American, the German American, Italian American, all very loud and clear. But when you ask for the voices of the children of Africa, you might as well go to the graveyard. We are missing in action. We are missing in action. That has got to change. What more proof do we need to know that we can no longer continue to be the most disrespected race on earth? What else do you need to understand that you gotta have a serious conversation with the image in the mirror and ask yourself some very important questions, painful as they may be? Why do you feel the white man's eyes is colder than the black man's eyes? Why do you dislike yourself so much? Why don't you trust your brother and sister? Why do you think the way you do? I often tell my white friends that sometimes I wish I could be a fly on the wall when you all are talking about the dumb things that we black people do. We do some of the dumbest things. I was talking to a niece of mine, and she was laughing at herself. She said she's a nurse. and they were getting ready to have a meeting. And some white nurse come along. She was sitting on the front row, and she found herself getting up, trying to give her a seat, and she thought to herself, oh, no, I've been listening to Auntie. I belong on this seat. So she ran back and sat back on her seat. But she had just gotten up and given up the seat because another white nurse had come to, sit, to come to the front row. She didn't think she belonged to the front row. We automatically take the back door. Nobody tells us to do that. We automatically feel inferior. Nobody has ever set us down and say you are inferior, but it has just been passed on from one generation.
Department will be joining us before the evening is over. I hope in his efforts to get here that he's all right, but he is not in fact here at the moment, and I'm going to extend to him because we've had continuing conversations about this effort and the ideas around this effort and the relationship between the community education effort and the formal education energies that are going on. We've been discussing this since Kemet this summer and when I first approached him with the idea. And Dr. Jeffries has been fully cooperative in this energy. I think he recognizes the value and the relationship of his position as an academician and the relationship of these kinds of lectures in the community. And so I know that Dr. Jeffries is fully in agreement with our energies and our efforts here, and I was hoping that he would be here to speak on that, but if he should arrive at some point, we would hope to have him do that for himself. At this time, I want to talk about the individual who has served as our guide on this 10-week historical analysis of our time here in America and in the Caribbean. Each week when I take Dr. Clark home, we discuss one thing or another. Usually he talks, I listen. And in the course of our conversations, I actually ran across a book that this dear elder has not read. And when I mentioned it to him, and he mentioned that someone else had mentioned the same book to him, and he hadn't mentioned it, and I brought the book up, so naturally I rolled my shoulders a little bit, because now we're on ground and he doesn't know, right? So I was taking full advantage of the fact that I had, in fact, found a volume critical to us as a people, or one that I am most assuredly impressed with, that this dear brother has not, in fact, read. And so by way of recognizing that by his having this volume, this man may, in fact, have read every volume there is everywhere, it is with great pleasure that I present to our dear brother, Dr. Clark, the volume Dry Long So, I know many of you know it, by John Henry Gwaltney. And I am assuming that with this volume, and I'm sure I'm not far from wrong, that this will mean that this dear brother has read it all. And so I'll take this opportunity, one, to introduce and have Dr. Clark begin his lecture for this evening, but also by way of showing our appreciation for his efforts, for his willingness to come and be a part of our energies here, and just for the fact that this profound brother has walked among us and shared with us his very presence. Please welcome Dr. John Henry Clark.
Thank Thank you very much. When I went home, I asked my children about the book. They had been sent to me. They had confiscated it before I could even open it. And there was no apology about it. They do that with a lot of my books. If they pick up the mail before I can get to it, if it's a good book that they want to read, they take it. And they give it back to me eventually when they finish with it. All right, just a few front things and we'll get underway. This is the last lecture in the two-part series, and we've become a kind of a family, and don't think you're getting rid of me, because I'll be coming back occasionally on Thursdays, depending on my teaching schedule, and I'm seriously thinking about just giving up teaching for a while for writing, so that means that I might be a Thursday or a Wednesday, depending on what is needed. I promise you an in-depth lecture on the Zulu people. I haven't forgotten it, and I won't forget it. After the commercialization of what once was a holy day, I guess we'll start arranging schedules, and there'll be a time. I'll come back for that. This Saturday, by way of giving an account of myself, I'll be going to Senegal for a pre-colloquium for the Festad. I'll be delivering a lecture from an extensive paper that has kind of broke my back this last month, Pan-Africanism, a History of an Idea in the African World. Because I'm a stickler for what is new and what is different, and I wouldn't walk across the street just to do the ordinary. So if I can't write something exceptional about a theme, many times I leave the theme to amateurs and to students. But I looked at this word Pan-Africanism because this is the only thing that's going to save us anyway, a real unity of African people. And I looked at some new information I have on the black untouchables of India, numbering more than 100 million, and how they became untouchables. In the introduction of the concept of untouchability, the large number of African people in the millions in the Pacific. And I looked again at my research file on the destruction of the African people in an island of Tasmania where every single man, woman, and child was put to death. I wondered again about the international position of African people. But in my approach to Pan-Africanism for Senegal, I did not start my approach to the subject with 1900 when H. Sylvester Williams of Trinidad called the first conference in London. I started it 500 years before, when slaves on a ship learned what we seem to have forgotten, that though they came from different parts of Africa, different so-called tribes, spoke different languages. They all had the same problem and the same oppressor. This very evening, in a meeting at the Caribbean Cultural Center, we were discussing African culture, how to reclaim it. An Afro-American girl said she's just beginning to understand her culture, and she resents the fact that people just talk about slavery instead of culture. And a Nigerian student, lady, said that she has no culture problem. I'm from Nigeria, and I'm acquainted with my culture, and I've had no cultural disruption, which proves she's brainwashed by the West. A large number of the slaves who came to the West were Yorubas from Nigeria. Most of the revolts were set in motion by Yorubas, led by Akans from Ghana. Now let me illustrate this for a moment, then I'm going to go into the lecture. Toussaint L'Ouverture was a can, but he didn't set the Haitian Revolution in motion. The person who set it in motion was a Yoruba, a bookman, a priest. The revolt in Guyana, led by Kofi, well led by Kofi, but the man that set it in motion was Ankara, a Yoruba. The Yorubas and the Akans developed a partnership away from Africa that they never had in Africa. The same thing is true of the revolts in Brazil. It is the Yoruba culture that held it together. And they couldn't get to them until they broke through that strong Yoruba culture. The main staying power of the revolt in the Western world was Yoruba. When we look at Nat Turner, Jim McVie, Gabriel Prosser, we find the same kind of process. Then the young lady said that she understands Thomas Sowell, because he said other ethnic groups built stores, factories, and pulled themselves up. And see no reason why blacks shouldn't do the same thing. A few years ago in a meeting in Washington, it was really a meeting of anti-Zionist Jews, and I happened to be one of the speakers. And afterward, some foreigner, a German, came over to me and says, "You know, Professor Clark, other groups in America have pulled themselves up by their bootstrings. Why haven't your people done the same thing?" I lost my cool and I said that because someone stole our boots, you racist. People are expecting the impossible of us, pulling yourself up by your bootstring, and you've got no boots. The neatest trick of the week, if you manage to bring it off. Then it's said, she said that, why don't blacks progress like other groups? I said, look, every group came here looking for something. We were not brought here to be given democracy, citizenship. When the American dream was dreamed, it wasn't dreamed for us. When the American promise was made, it wasn't made to us. At the turn of the century, our family was less than 50 years old. because during slavery, it was against the law to have a family. Now, you expect our family to be the same as other people's family? We just put it together day before yesterday? Now, the same man who's judging you and writing the textbooks about you is the man that broke up your family in the first place and made it a law, against the law, for someone to teach you to read. That's the same man that called you dumb. And too many times, we accept the blame for a lot of things. A lack of stimulation. A lack of black hero worship. Where you going to see a black hero? You look at all the television you look at. Where are you going to see a black hero? Remember when Bill Cosby played in I Spy? He couldn't even get a black woman. And when he got one, he lost. The other guy was knocking over blondes and brunettes all over the place. Oh, no, they said a black man is a criminal if he has feelings the other way, but the mass media has given him feelings the other way. Because the mass media in 20 minutes can do more educating than other people can do in 20 hours. With our kids looking at all these misconceptions of the hero, never seeing himself emerge as the hero. He has some misconceptions about himself and his ability to be a hero. In this evening's discussion, talking about culture, and how to infuse our culture into the curricula. Everybody forgot to emphasize that slavery was a war on our culture. It was a war on the culture of all the non-European people of the whole world. And that the most cultured people in the world were told they had no culture and also had no God that was worth worshiping. So the European not only gave you a new psyche, a new mentality, new clothes to wear, a new God to worship, then he didn't have to build jails. His building jails was redundant because he already had you in one and still have you in one. When I look at this beautiful Nigerian girl spouting all this conservative nonsense, but she knows her history already, and I just asked her a simple question. How did Nigeria get its name? It wasn't always named Nigeria. How did it get its name? All right, very simple. Near the end of the 19th century, Lord Lugard was governing all that territory for England, and the chartered companies, these commercial companies, had their own armies governing each territory, all them rapers, all them gangsters. Same as the two gangsters in Washington now arguing over territory. You think you got a friend among them. You take the east side, I take the west side. Don't you bother my territory, I won't bother yours. The
They ain't talking about socialism, and one's a socialist. They ain't talking about capitalism, and one's a capitalist. They ain't talking about Christianity, and one's a Christian. They ain't talking about democracy, and another one's supposed to believe in that. They're talking about territory, how to control it. And the fact that the white people of the world have dwindled to one-fifth of the world's population, and if they don't watch themselves in bed or out of bed, they, we will discover they are the minority. But once they put it together, they're going to have to ask them for permission. Once we remember the one thing about power is the ability to include and exclude, there's a whole lot of people they're going to have to deal with. All right, now back to the subject. Because we have a lot of miseducated African people around the world. We've got a lot of African people who can be educated overnight. They're so hungry for it. When they had the difficulty in Fiji, when they discovered that some American blacks were interested in that case and some Africans were interested in that case, they said, we thought we were alone in the world. We didn't know we had so many relatives. They had no problem becoming African people. They had no problem relating to the other relatives in the world. Glad to do it. We're a big family. Now, my talk for tonight, and unfortunately the last in the series, will deal almost solely with the African Americans, the lonely nation away from home. Because the African American is the most misunderstood, most abused, most wounded of all the African people who live outside of Africa. And yet, he is the target for destruction by more forces than any other African people. He's the one African that the Western world won't destroy. Principally because he has grown insensitive to his oppressor, and he more than any other Africans have fought in larger numbers for his oppressor and mastered his oppressor's modern war technique. He's also the most dangerous African on the face of the earth because he is the only African on the face of the earth trained in the modern warfare technique called combined operations. Combined operations is the art of striking a target land, air, and sea. No other Africans on the face of the earth have enough training to move on a target with ships, aeroplanes, and infantry. And the black American has been trained to do all three. He wasn't trained to do this to liberate himself or to liberate anyone. He was trained to do this for someone else. But the training is still with him. But he has never converted his training into a liberation army for himself. After World War II, Africa could have picked up almost for nothing one of the finest black air forces on the face of the earth. But because Africa was not ready to do this, their talent deteriorated. Many of the men were busting dishes and clerking and lost all their skills. But I'm saying that the skill and the training to make a modern army was with the black American. And right now, right this very minute, there's been enough black Americans discharged from the U.S. Army with enough modern skill they can train a modern army for every nation in Africa. This is what makes him the target for the colonialists, because they realize if contact is ever made with him, and if he becomes aware of his skills and affect the wedding between his skills in Africa, he could change the world around. He could have stopped the Congo situation. He can revitalize any nation in Africa. Because of his training, he can learn faster than almost any other African on the face of the earth. The question is, why then do we have slums? If he can fix houses, why don't he fix them? Why then do we have dope? Why is his institution deteriorating? Why is he debating his integration instead of maintaining his institution? Because his mind has been trained into dependency. I'm saying that one thing about Jim Crow, one thing about that oppression, it was real. And you had something being built for him, by him, to sustain his institutions and sustain himself, and he had no illusion about the fact that he could depend on someone else to do it for him. There was a time you either went to a black college or you didn't go to no college at all. You went to a black church and you didn't go to no church at all, because you were not then and still are not welcome in the white church. And blacks created not only a new church institution, but a new religion and a new approach to God. And preached as though the God they were addressing that message to was totally different from the God the white folks were talking about and talking to. They may well be true. Jimmy Swagger's God can't possibly be mine. This was the survival of African culture. All right. Let's see how the mystery was set in motion and what makes the difference. The difference is not that anything to do with who's got the best brain. The difference has got nothing to do with personal bravery. The difference has got to do with the isolation in the nature of oppression and what each one had to react to. And the difference has got to do with what oppressor left you with illusions and what oppressors did. Now, a few weeks ago, only 3 weeks ago, in the meeting on Marcus Garvey in Jamaica, I said, because I didn't want to disturb a lot of people by saying it in the public lecture, but in the private gathering, I said, now that the public is not here and we're just here having ourselves some nice Jamaican food and drink together, let's level with each other. Marcus Garvey is 47 years dead. If Marcus Garvey were alive today walking in the streets of Jamaica, somebody might stone him, advocating the same thing. And yet what Marcus Garvey advocated is the most important thing that is needed not only in Jamaica, but in the whole of the African world. Now, he rarely ever used the word Pan-Africa. And yet, he was the ultimate Pan-Africanist, fighting for the unity of the whole of the African world. And as though it was planned, while I was in Jamaica, the very next day, they gave medals to the Jamaicans who participated in the invasion of Grenada. A contradiction to end all contradictions. I explained that he did not succeed in Jamaica principally because the Jamaicans then and now have the illusion of nation. And we in the United States then and now was never given the illusion of nation. They will let us know right now that they don't want us here. And they didn't let us dream that we were part of this nation. They let us know that we were brought to do a set labor. And once the labor was over, we were a surplus population. A nation within a nation without a nationality. We were not brought to this country to be given a nationality. We were not brought to this country to be given a status. When they said liberty and justice for all, we were not a part of the all. No one let us dream or think that we were part of the all. When we look at the atrocities against us day by day, they keep saying again and again, not you. When I say American citizen, I don't mean you. Now, we have, this nation has mortgaged its soul and lived a lie and tells a lie to the world because they dare not face up to the fact that you've got a massive nation inside of the United States living in under a condition many times worse than Nazism. The United States can address itself to Russian Jewry, all about human rights. Don't you think this girl, these cops, rape has human rights? They won't address themselves to any issue of this kind. Well, all right. Because we have not examined the illusion that went into the original entry in the United States that wouldn't go away, we can't deal with the present because we think that maybe this country has betrayed us. This country has not betrayed us, didn't promise you anything in the first place. Because it wasn't talking to you. If you're in an English country, they give you the illusion that they're talking to you. Read the Mansfield decision on slavery. He who touches British soil, breathes British air, becomes a free man. That sounds real good. British kept slavery 100 years after that. Mansfield decision. You think the British becoming liberal? Nothing. They were freeing the slaves in England because the slave was redundant in England. Wasn't even needed in England. And either you had to free the slaves or put in England or put down a revolt of the British working class who wanted their jobs. So he didn't free them out of benevolence. He freed them out of necessity. Well, now when we arrived in the country had not worked out its racial pattern. 1619, 1 year before the Mayflower. And we won't talk about the Mayflower people because they're not exactly my favorite people anyway. And I often tell my students, if someone say they came over on the Mayflower, descended from those people, do not laugh directly in their face. Cup your head and laugh to one side. Have good manners. Those were discards, degenerates, thrown out of Harlem, fornicating with the sisters and the mothers in the street. Then they came to America and began to oppress the Indians. Then the governor of the Massachusetts colony wrote back to England, "No, why did you send these people over here?" But when we arrived, they had not worked out the pattern. They hadn't even worked out the color scheme. And there were so many poor whites who were indentured servants, and we became indentured servants, not chattel slaves at first. And so the white indentured servant and the black indentured servant didn't see any difference in their status, so they got along well and married each other and with no eyebrows raised about it. Poor was poor. And they were all treated terribly in the filthy ships that they brought the British indentured servants over was known was about as filthy as the one that brought the Africans over. So now you had to create a color scheme to put the poor whites against the blacks. While when England had put the poor whites, posed the poor whites against the blacks from the beginning by giving the whites job categories that always made them look above and better than the blacks. And most of these whites were poor Irish. You don't talk about the Irish not as really some of the first of the indentured servants. These poor Irish became the most ruthless slave drivers. Simon Legree and Uncle Tom's Cabin was Irish. We don't examine our literature on the subject because people beat on our head in order to impress someone else there. Someone else.
To understand what I'm talking about, you have to understand once more the design of the country. White male Protestant, middle class and up, those who agreed with the prevailing political status quo and who own property. Everybody in this country is trying to impress that group. The Jews are trying to impress that group. The Catholics are trying to impress that group. That is the big rooster in the pecking order. And if you watch chickens in a yard, the big rooster can peck anybody. But instead of pecking him, you peck the next smallest one till you get down to the bitty. But you don't peck the first pecker, which is the rooster. This is what you call the pecking order. You pass the peck down, but you don't pass it up. So the Gentile, white male Protestant, is the rooster in the barnyard. He has his way. And if you look at a book called 60 American Families, the richest people in this country falls into that category right now. In the same 60 families and their descendants who control the major wealth in the country at the turn of the century still control the major wealth in the country. All right, now, back to what happened to that original group, 16-19 group. About 20. They worked their way out of indenture. They became landowners. And one Anthony Johnson became a slave owner. And why we know so much about this is because slaves could at that time take their master to court for brutal treatment, and one of his slaves had to take him to court. This is why we got a record of it. Now, I'm not proud of a black slaveholder, but as a matter of record, there were some black slaveholders. And Carter G. Woodson's book on the early black families, it's additional documentation for this. Now, our history in this country is working our way around all these illusions and assuming that certain promises were made to us that were not made to us, taking handouts and crumbs from the table while other groups at other places fare a little better, but do not assume that slavery was mild anyplace. Slavery was different, and being different does not mean it is less harsh. I mean the slave owner was less crude in his administration of the system, but he still administered the system. He still killed. He still sold families from families. All right, now come the American Revolution. We hear all this talk about liberty and justice for all. We believe some of it. Now, again, we have to go over a neglected but well-documented part of our history, the presence of a large number of Caribbean activists in our movement before the American Revolution and after the American Revolution. Why Prince Hall of Barbados, founder of the Masons? Why Peter Ogden, Antigua, founder of the Odd Fellows? Why Russ Wamm, one of the first to graduate from a college, one of the editors of Freedom's Journal? Why Robert Campbell, another Jamaican, who would go out with Delaney and search for a place for settlement? Why this harmony between two African people who don't seem to have much harmony now? Why did they display so much good sense in the 1880s, in the 1800s, and in the 1900s? And we play, and we're talking so much nonsense to each other in the 1900s, going to the 21st century. What has happened to us? What made these visiting Caribbeans have a certain kind of nerve and inject a certain kind of sparkle in our movement? It wasn't there. They came from a system that gave them the illusion that a free man was free. These were free blacks, as against slaves. But a free black in the United States were free in quotes and limited in what he could do. The free black from the Caribbean were no freer, but he had the illusion that he was supposed to be freer, and he acted accordingly. And yet they gave something to the whole movement that wasn't there. They would help set in motion the colonization society. Ruslan would go to Liberia, find the Liberian Herald, a newspaper still in existence. In the 1850s, they stopped coming in any appreciable numbers. And the free black in the United States began to visit them, because while there was still slavery in Jamaica, throughout the whole Caribbean island, they were free enough to invite black Americans in the struggle to come down and rest up a while. All right, now let's look at the scene they had and the scene we had. In the mental depression brought on by our scene and the slight relief brought on by their scene. They were on an island. They were the majority. When you are the majority, though you are a slave, you get the feeling that ultimately you are going to be the master of the land. And that's true, because most of the time you are going to be the master of the land. They could go up in the hills of Jamaica, and sometimes for months and almost a year they wouldn't see a white man. There was no place we could go, for we didn't see him or reminded of his awesome power. Now look what is happening to that mentality. Wilson Huggins would say years later, we rise each morning and petition for the right to live to the end of the day.
Lady J.
And the next morning we have to petition all over again. Because this is where the phrase going to meet the man, literally going to get permission to live one more day. But if you're way up in the hills, most of the time you don't see him. So the psychological impact of his presence on your mind is not there. And you know he owns the land, you know he's the master. But physically, you're not looking him in the face every day. So this relieves the mind of being reminded constantly. While in this country, the idea was to drive us stark, raving mad, and he damn near succeeded. You have to understand what happened. These two different people, all African people now, one living under one set of people, more brutal than the other, still white people, but one is more brutal than the other. One has no tact at all. The British understand slavery is a business, and they handled it as a business. The American was a sloppy businessman. And sometimes he would kill his investor, his investment, unnecessarily. I didn't say the British didn't kill. He killed sometimes to warn others that you better not revolt, or you better not step out of line. But he didn't kill for frivolous reasons. He killed for control reasons. Killed one to control a thousand. That's thinking. Brutal thinking, but thinking. America didn't think that way then, don't think that way now. So we had this to contend with. After the American Revolution, now you can see why in the 1850s we would not only need spokesmen, we would begin to create an intellectual atmosphere in the New England states different. We began to create a church atmosphere that was different. And we had to create it that was different. There were very few independent churches in the Caribbean. They're tied to some European church, Scottish church, British church. There was no need because the missionaries, the Moravians and other missionaries, let you in their churches and administer too, but this didn't happen to us. So we had no choice but to build the independent institutions because we were working with a different kind of psyche and relationship to the white people we had to deal with. See, more and more we're becoming isolated from the Africans and isolated from the Caribbean people. This is what I mean, the lonely African nation away from home. Still an African people, no different from any other African people when we left. The difference is the nature of oppression and the nature of the oppressor and our reaction to it. All right, slavery was hard in the Caribbean islands. Slavery was hard here. Why why didn't the blues appear in the Caribbean islands? Why didn't the spirituals appear? It had nothing to do with the lack of culture. But the blues and the spirituals are part of our self-induced psychiatry. We had to have it. We have to have relief. We develop through our church and through our reading and misreading of the Bible a romance for Jewish people that we still have. We wanted to associate with a people who escaped from something. Now you can see why we're saying, go down, Moses, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. What are you talking about? Let your people go. When they become your people? Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. Now, who was the Pharaoh? The one your people? Now, if you read the real history of the story, it comes out differently. They were collaborators with the invaders of Africa. When the Africans came to power, the Africans said that whosoever obeys African law may stay. And those who don't want to obey African law, now that the Africans are back in power, have to go. Those were the ones who decided they wasn't going to obey African law. How did they get to be your people? Go down, Moses. Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. Now, because we do not dig deep enough into African folklore, we don't even know where the first story is recorded about someone parting the sea. We don't know where the Jews copied the story from. And they copied it and said it really happened. This is allegory. Allegory don't have to be true. Caesar B. DeMille made a fortune out of it. Died with so much money, great-grandchildren won't finish spending it. Charleston Heston made a god of money on it. But he won't know one of the first African stories about parting the sea. A pharaoh was kind of despondent. And so in order to cheer him up, he wanted to go on rowing on the Nile. So all the rowers, the ladies rowing the boat were beautiful ladies. And so the chief lady rowing the boat up ahead was rowing. Then she leaned over and dropped her bracelet in the Nile. She stopped rowing. She got despondent. I ain't gonna row no more. Lost my bracelet. A necklace or something. So the magician, remember, magic had a lot to do with the creation of religions. As a two-volume work, Religion and Magic. All right. And so the magician was wrong. She told him. She dropped a necklace or a bracelet. He said, oh, right away. So he stepped out, parted the Nile. Then it got dry, reached down, picked up a bracelet, gave it to her. Water came down, and she rode the boat on. Everybody was happy. That's the first story. That story was 3,000 years before the Hebrew entry. But if you look at African literature, you can find a duplication of all these stories. And I think some of our spirituals will be changed around. Marian Anderson was singing a story in Egypt, and the Egyptians asked her to stop. I mean the Arabs. There's no such thing as Egyptians. Egyptians don't rule Egypt. Arabs rule Egypt. Right now, the Arabs weren't even a people when all this was happening. So they had nothing to do with none of the greatness of Egypt. The Arabs didn't have nothing to do with it. He was the one that came in and robbed all those graves and stole all that gold. And took some of the stone and built mosques. Some of the mosques are still there. So you call the Arab an Egyptian, you're wrong. But we got a whole lot of misconception. Another one is in the song, Deep River, My Home Is Over Jordan. How did your home get to be over Jordan? Beautiful song. You should have heard Marian Anderson in her great days. God, she could put you there. That was a singer. Pity she didn't record more. Pity Roland Hayes didn't record more either. What I'm saying is that a circumstance of history shaped each one of us a separate way. And today, sometime when we are boasting among ourselves, all we're saying is my slave master was better than your slave master, which is the most stupid argument that people can ever have. If you're against slavery, then no slave master is good. You get to, a Bajan would say that his slavery was mild and in Barbados in comparison to in Jamaica. So who in the hell cares? What difference did it make? Was still slavery? Slavery wasn't mild any place. Slavery was hard every place. All right. There was a time in Barbados when the rich planters took up all the good land, and the poor planters, slaves and all, picked up and settled along the sea island of Georgia and the cheap land along the American coast of the South. And the people that they brought with them spoke a combination of English and African. This is the origin of the Geechee. The Geechee is nothing but a Bajan. And I've had a Bajan language check it out and prove it positively to be true. But it wasn't a mild situation there either. But I'm saying that that first half of the 19th century, the newspaper building period, the magazine building period, the slave narrative building period, none of this happened in the Caribbean. And if none of this happened in the Caribbean, it had nothing to do with one person's mentality being different from the other. One's illusions and one's condition dictated one thing, and another condition dictated another. Because we were living under the most brutal of all oppressors, we would get an outlet in the spirituals and in the blues. We would sing our way out of it, or try to pray our way out of it. Or we would adopt other people's folklore and fasten ourselves to it any place to soothe ourselves or to even pretend that ultimately we would be free. Now, on the eve of the Civil War, it was the black abolitionists, too often neglected, Douglas and others, that solidified the cause and made the issue of slavery an emotional issue on the eve of that war. then you look at the Caribbean islands on the eve of emancipation and look at the United States on the eve of the Civil War in emancipation, you're looking at two different stories. You're looking at two different stories because two different people, both Africans, are acting or reacting to oppression in a different way because they've got different oppressors and must act in a different way and have no choice but to do so. African Americans would go into that war and in one battle alone win 16 Congressional Medals of Honor. It had never been done before. Why did they fight so bravely for a nation that had betrayed them and that still betrayed them? They had the illusion that if they show their manhood, maybe someone will reward them with the concept of citizenship. It was a gamble. But the gamble didn't totally pay off, didn't totally lose either. Because after the Civil War, there was 11 years of pseudo-democracy. Blacks came to power briefly in the South, congressmen, two senators, males, more males in the South than they've got right now. Males in cities in the South that have no black males now. Galveston, Texas, and a whole lot of places. The position of mayor is one thing, but blacks had certain key state positions in the South during this period that they don't have now, like state position, state director of the state treasurer, head of the state parties, solicitor generals on a state level. Now, immediately after emancipation, you want to know, where did all these educated blacks come from? Some of these blacks were mulattoes, in fact, most of them were, whose white father had staked them to an education, even sent some of them to medical schools in Edinburgh, Scotland. They were the leaders mainly because they could read and write, and this explained why most of the leadership that appeared in black America immediately after the Civil War were light-complected. This was not a thing like design. Now, if you look at Jamaica, it was a thing of design. And the United States was a thing of convenience. I'm not passing judgment on either one. I'm merely stating a fact. Mavis Campbell, who I talked to today, a brilliant Jamaican journalist and researcher, in her book, The Jamaican Color, the Socio-Political History, done the best job on color manifestation early 19th century Jamaica until the beginning of the 20th century. All right, the second half of that century, we faced some problems that we haven't dealt with and finished dealing with to this day. We had been betrayed. There had been an attempt to sell us back into slavery. The promises of the Reconstruction had been betrayed. And the white friends we had in Congress, it was really only two, one in Congress and one a senator, Thaddeus Stevens and Sumner, had been blocked off. Not much we could do. Liberia had been settled. The colonization movement was underway. A little known movement we need to study again, the Negro Convention movement, was meeting every year. We are the meetingest and the talkingest people in all the world. We call more meetings, pass more resolutions, and get less done than any people in the world. We will meet and vote and forget what we voted for. We were meeting then. Our lodges, women branch, men branch. For that last 25 years, we began to face reality and shared illusions as we never done before. Bishop Turner on the scene, the fiery Georgia Presbyterian, the Back to Africa advocate, the whole concept of Back to Africa before Marcus Garvey, the Chief Sam movement, another Back to Africa movement that appeared in Oklahoma. Chief Sam was a Ghanaian who was going to get some ships and take all of us back. The ships never appeared. A lot of people sold that material, gathered at Galveston, Texas, waiting for the ships to come to take them away. Ships never appeared. They had to go on back home, shame of face, and buy some more furniture and try to live in America. When I say that we are the loneliest nation, we are the lonely African away from home, we are the ones who were invited to the United States, and when we finished laboring, the labor, the jobs became obsolete. To this day, no African nation has invited us to come home officially. The same as Israel has a law that any Jew who wants to return can return. Africa has no such law. Not one nation in all Africa. And yet Africa has more space than Israel. 1,000 times more. In fact, all black Americans fit into one corner of the Sudan and they wouldn't miss the space. Under proper cultivation, we could feed ourselves there too. But the African has been brainwashed into not inviting us home. So we came into the 20th century with illusions. We came into the 20th century with hope. We came into the 20th century changing leadership and arguing about old leadership. It was the Booker T. Washington period. It's the beginning of the Du Bois period. It was the period of the radical black journalists, especially T. Thomas Fortune and Monroe Trotter. It was an outspoken period. It was also a period of riots until we entered the period of the First World War. Marcus Garvey would arrive soon after. He would challenge Du Bois as the center of leadership. And he would succeed where Du Bois had failed, principally because Marcus Garvey could reach an audience that Du Bois could not reach. Du Bois, with his Oxford accent, is Harvard accent. He was always correct, but he did not reach out in such a way to entice the masses of people. what Garvey brought was some illusions taken from his growth in Jamaica. The dream of ships, the dream of nation, the dream of wholeness, and a concept that came out of his maroon background, the idea of redemption and the idea of avenging old wrongs. He was listened to by millions of people, principally because he spoke a language and had a spirit that instantaneously communicated what many of the other intellects did not. We're not dealing with right or wrong. We're dealing with appeal. There had been great men of appeal in this country, but none the equal of a Garvey. Bishop Turner's preaching was mostly in Georgia, in the southern area. Du Bois was mostly among the intellect and the people he called the talented ten. A lot of blacks did not read Monroe Trotter's The Boston Guardian. Nor did they read The Age on another great journalist, T. Thomas Fortune, who many times wrote speeches for Booker T. Washington. Blacks entered the war and came out with more illusions. In the 20s, Marcus Garvey is getting a massive organization underway. Now there's several political strings running side by side as a literary organization, a movement called the Harlem Renaissance. Marcus Garvey is the political stimulants for that renaissance. He's given the lonely nation away from home a reason for being. So they invest in his ships and his schemes. And while they regret having lost a lot, they did not cry, because he gives them a meaning, a stimulus for living different from anything they ever had in their life. It is a lie to say that Marcus Garvey found black America with a wishbone and gave them a backbone. They had a backbone before. They fought before, and they fought hard. But he had a way of communicating, a charismatic way of communicating, that made them think of things that they had never previously considered. And that was one of his great gifts. After his difficulty going to jail and being deported back to his native Jamaica, America would soon go into the Depression. He would be forgotten until the Italian-Ethiopian War. During the Italian-Ethiopian War, he would remind us, and we would remind ourselves, we need to reconsider what he had been said about nations. Because no people can be whole without a concept of nation and nation formation. And he understood something, and this is why he was successful in building the largest mass organization ever right here in the United States. He could never have built it in Jamaica, couldn't build it in Jamaica of that day, couldn't build it in Jamaica of this day. Because the Jamaicans had the illusion that they have a nation. We had no illusion. We had no illusions about being wanted in this country, because the Americans have let us know we were not wanted. So a drowning man, when you throw him a rope, he have no time to analyze who threw the rope. He pulls on the rope. You don't try to grab both ends of it either. All we knew that we needed some form of rescue, and we were desperate people. Now, as we moved into the period of the Depression, the Depression literally solidified our ranks. But it was the Italian-Ethiopian War that made us think of nation again, made us think of wholeness, the protection of nation, made us relive some of Marcus Garvey's teachings about nation and nation structure. And it was with this and all the misgivings that we entered another war with doubts and wondering what we would get out of it. But we had no enthusiasm for the Second World War and didn't suspect that we would get anything out of it. This is why after the war, when the Supreme Court decision about segregation, 1954, we were rather cynical.